We concluded the previous presentation with Colossians chapter 1, verse 24. I'd like to repeat that verse now and then focus on what Paul calls the afflictions of the Messiah, the place of suffering in Jesus' life. And I want to look only at two key scenes. One, the agony in the garden, and two, Jesus dying on the cross. Colossians 1:24 reads, "I'm now rejoicing in my sufferings," says Paul, "for your sake, and I'm completing what is lacking in my flesh of the afflictions of the Messiah for the sake of his body, the church." We look at Mark chapter 14, who describes the agony in the garden. Jesus facing his bitter struggle alone. Mark writes, "They went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, 'Sit here while I pray.' He took with him Peter and James and John, and he began to be distressed and agitated. He said to them, 'I'm deeply grieved, even to death. Stay here, keep awake.' And going a little farther, he threw himself on the ground and prayed that, if it were possible, the hour might pass him by. And he said, 'Abba, Father, for you all things are possible. Remove this cup from me, but let your will, not mine, be done.'" Jesus' distress is obvious. What does he have in mind when he says, "Let your will, not mine, be done"? Jesus' will is clear. He's just expressed it. There's too much to do yet. Jesus wants to carry out his Father's will, which is the mission given him by God. And he's, 2 or 3 years, not very long, he's been carrying out that mission of love beautifully. But there, hardly anything's changed. The high priest and the Sanhedrin, they haven't shifted. The Pharisees are still good men, presumably, but fixed on an idea of the law which Jesus has been challenging. The crowds are fickle. The Romans and the Sicarii, the group who are anti-Roman, they're the same. So Jesus could be excused for thinking, "I failed. I have failed in my mission. I just wanted to convince people that love is the way. I wanted Jerusalem to embrace God, who is a God of love. I wanted my disciples to learn to love their enemies and stop this cycle of fear and violence. But who's listening? The disciples aren't ready yet." Jesus can sense that they're just not ready to be without him. And yet the vultures are gathering. He can feel the pressure of this determination of the Jewish leadership to capture Jesus and to get him tried by the Romans and crucified. And the circle is getting narrower. He wants to do God's will. Did he think that he'd failed? Maybe I should have been. I should have been less hard on the Pharisees. Maybe I challenged them too strongly. Maybe I shouldn't have come to Jerusalem when I did. I don't know what was going through Jesus' mind, but whatever it was, he wants time. He needs time. He needs to do more, to wake up the people to know God as love. There's just too much healing that has to happen, too much truth that needs to be spoken. But in that garden pain, we're meant through these words we've just listened to realize that at the end of his prayer, Jesus actually came to a place we've all got to come to. He came to a place of conviction that whatever's going to happen, he will do God's will. Now, as I'll show you in a moment from the scriptures, that doesn't mean God wanted Jesus to get crucified. For heaven's sake, that's dreadful. That God doesn't will or intend murder or injustice. But God does want something. He wants Jesus, whatever happens, to love, to keep loving. And that's what Jesus comes to, the end of that agony of prayer. I know what I'll do, said Jesus. Whatever others do, I can't control, and I don't know what that'll be. But whatever they're doing, I will carry out God's will. I'll keep eating with sinners. I'll keep embracing lepers. I'll keep challenging the religious authorities to go and learn the meaning of their tradition. I'll keep loving, come what may. That it's not God's will for Jesus to be crucified is clear from the New Testament. I'll read you some texts. I mean, it's obvious, but some of us have been taught as though that's what it was, that God planned this crucifixion to save us. The more we look at that, the more it makes no sense. And it also continues the bad habit of presenting God wrongly. Jesus never thought that. In the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 3, there's a speech given by Peter, and listen to its words. He says, God has glorified his servant Jesus, whom you handed over and rejected in the presence of Pilate. Though Pilate had decided to release him, but you rejected the Holy and Righteous One. You asked to have a murderer given to you, and you killed the author of life. God raised him from the dead. To this we are witnesses. It could hardly be clearer. The murder was a sinful act of human beings, contrary to God's will. God's role was to sustain his son and raise him from the dead. In Acts chapter 7, Stephen prays. He says to the leaders, "You stiff-necked people, you're forever opposing the Holy Spirit, just as your ancestors used to do. Which of the prophets did your ancestors not persecute? They killed those who foretold the coming of the righteous one. And now you have become his betrayers and murderers. In Paul's first letter to the Thessalonians, chapter 2, he writes, "You," this is the Christians in Thessalonica, "you became imitators of the churches of God in Christ Jesus that are in Judea. For you suffered the same things from your own compatriots as they did from the Jews, who killed both the Lord Jesus and the prophets, and drove us out. They displease God." Notice Paul doesn't say they were carrying out the will of God. On the contrary, they displease God. Psalm 5, verse 4 reads, "You, O God, are not a God who delights in sin." Jesus' last parable, it's not among the earlier parables, it's right at the end, gives us an insight into Jesus' own understanding of what was happening to him. Jesus tells the story about an owner of the vineyard who sent slaves to collect the produce. Some they beat, others they killed. He had still one other, a beloved son. Finally, the owner sent his son to them, saying, "Surely they respect my son." But those tenants said to one another, "This is the heir. Come, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." So they seized him, they killed him, and threw him out of the vineyard. God sends Jesus a mission of love, and Jesus has God saying, "Surely, surely thou respect my son." Yeah, there may be reasons why they rejected Isaiah and Jeremiah and the other prophets. It could be very confusing, but heck, how could they possibly reject Jesus? In John chapter 8, verse 37, we have Jesus saying, "You are looking for an opportunity to kill me," comma. And he doesn't say, "because though you don't realize it, you're carrying out God's eternal will," or some such words. He says, "You're looking for an opportunity to kill me because there's no place in you for my word." They're precisely not listening to Jesus. They're not open to the revelation of God as love. In John chapter 8, verse 28, we're told, Jesus said, "When you've lifted up the Son of Man, then you'll realize that I am." The Greek is ego eimi, which goes right back to the scene of the burning bush when Moses pleads with God to tell Moses God's name so that Moses can tell the people who sent him. And God's saying, "Look, you can't give me a name. I am." Well, here it is, Jesus saying, "When you've lifted up the Son of Man, you'll realize that I am, and that I do nothing on my own. I speak these things as the Father instructed me, and the one who sent me is with me. He has not left me alone. I always do what is pleasing to him. And in the letter to the Hebrews, chapter 5, verse 7, the author says, in the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to the one who was able to save him from death. That's a very good description of what's happening in the agony in the garden. And the author adds, and he was heard because of his reverent submission. He was heard. God heard Jesus' cry in the agony. And why? How do we know that? Because God responded by sustaining Jesus in his embrace and making Jesus able to continue loving even when faced with the sinful behavior of the Roman and Jewish leadership. So I'll pray it again. In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to the one who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverent submission. Although he was son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And having been made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him. So I'll take you back to the agony in the garden. Jesus suffering. As Paul said, the afflictions of the Messiah. Abba, Father, for you all things are possible. Remove this cup from me, yet let your will, not mine, be done. So now we go to Calvary. Mark 15:37 writes, Jesus gave a loud cry and breathed his last, and the curtain of the temple was rent in two from top to bottom. What's the meaning of this? The curtain, as you know, this is not literal, we're not saying the curtain in the temple was ripped 100 yards down the road. The curtain was there to veil God's face, as it were. So the people who wanted to come to see the face of God, all they could do was see the veil. Behind the veil, invisible, was the presence of God on the mercy seat above the Ark of the Covenant. Well, no one could actually see the face of God. Mark is telling us here in a very powerful symbol that when Jesus died, when he breathed his last, when he gave out his spirit, the curtain was ripped. Now anyone looking can see, as they look at Jesus on the cross, they can see the face of God. We can all see what God looks like in a human way to us humans. God looks like someone who has given everything, poured out his life in love right to the end. the text continues, when the centurion who stood facing Jesus saw how he died, not that he died, the centurion, there were another two deaths that afternoon anyhow, and this is his job, so death's a commonplace for him. But this something wasn't commonplace, and it was how Jesus died, the manner of his dying. And when he saw how Jesus died, he said, truly, this man was God's son. In Mark's gospel, the very first opening verse is the beginning of the gospel of Jesus the Christ, the Son of God. The whole gospel is focusing on Jesus and presenting him as the Son of God. In other words, when we look at Jesus, we're looking at the Son. Jesus is revealing his Father, the source of everything he is, everything he says, and everything he does. At the baptism, as described by Mark, and tradition is that the Gospel of Mark was the Gospel of Peter, so we're getting a beautiful presentation of the meaning of the baptism of Jesus. He says, the words were spoken at the baptism, you are my beloved Son. And at the Transfiguration, almost the same words, God says, this is my beloved Son, listen to him. So we look at the death of Jesus, the dying of Jesus. His death was brought about by others and can only be seen as a sin. The way he died was not determined by anyone else. It was determined by Jesus himself, able to die so beautifully because he was in communion with God. It was Jesus' love-giving, self-giving, life-giving that God willed. And thanks to Jesus' fidelity to his Father's will, not even the injustice and disobedience of those who crucified Jesus could thwart God's eternal design. Mark and Matthew place on the lips of Jesus his last words. The first verse of Psalm 22, which reads, my God, why have you abandoned me? So we're meant to, that Jesus is very real. He's not only suffering, but he's feeling, not at the level of faith, but at the level of feeling, he feels abandoned even by God. And that is placed on his lips. We're meant to, the gospel writer is saying, read right through Psalm 22, because we don't know a better hymn, a better poem than Psalm 22 to get some insight into Jesus' psyche as he was crucified. It's a beautiful psalm. It goes right down to the depths of pain and abandonment, but then halfway through it turns and it rises to the most exquisite hymn of praise and glory and gratitude. Psalm 22, verse 10, I'll just pick that one verse for you, reads, "You have been my God." I'll give you the Hebrew. Eli, El is God. Eli is my God. Ata means you. My God, you. Eli, Ata. Something strange happens on Calvary. The bystanders, some of them, say, "Oh, he's calling on Elijah." Well, what may have given them that idea? Well, I think it's possible it could be this, because Psalm 22, verse 10, maybe they were the actual words prayed by Jesus and alerted anyone listening to go back to Psalm 22. Because Jesus' words, Eli, Eli, my God, Ata, you, if you listen to them, and I'll just pause in a different place, Eliyata, Eliyata, Eliya is Elijah. Ta, in Aramaic, means come. He's calling on Elijah. Perhaps, I don't know, of course, but perhaps that was what Jesus actually said. What he actually said was, "My God, you." But it was heard as Elijah, come. John chapter 19, verse 38, places on the lips of Jesus these words, "I thirst. I thirst. Thirst for love. Thirst for communion with God. Thirst to see the crowd changing, listening, learning to love. Thirsting for the souls of the Roman soldiers and the authorities, Pilate, and thirsting for the Jewish leadership, and thirsting for the love of Judas, thirsting that his whole mission was about loving, and at the end he's thirsting for love, ultimately thirsting for God's love." Luke places on the lips of Jesus on the cross. They're all trying to give us their insights into this extraordinary happening. Luke has Jesus say, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." It's taken from another psalm, Psalm 31, verse 5. And I understand that was the normal psalm for the night prayer of an observant Jew. It's a beautiful prayer. "Father, into my hands, into your hands, I commend my spirit." Yes, he's on the one hand feeling abandoned by God, feeling abandoned, but he never lost trust. He never lost faith. And so he's giving his last breath, breathing it out to his Abba, God, and breathing out the Spirit to us. John in verse 19, verse 34, tells us, "One of the soldiers pierced Jesus' side with a spear, and at once blood and water came out." Behind that there are two scenes from the Bible. One is in Numbers chapter 20, where Moses strikes the rock. The rock is a symbol of God. And Moses strikes the rock. An image of the sin of the people who didn't believe God and were wanting to go back to Egypt. And what was God's response to that sin, that striking at the heart of God? Water poured forth from the rock to quench their thirst. It's the prophet Zechariah, chapter 12, verse 10, who says, they will look on the one they have pierced. King Josiah, we're going back to the end of the 6th century BC, King Josiah was killed at Megiddo by the Egyptian army, etc. And the people are totally shocked because he was such a good person and he'd done his best to get the people to do God's will. He'd reformed the government and all of this. Surely God would look after him, but he was killed. And Zechariah, the prophet, is looking and saying, they'll look on the one they've pierced. And that's what we're asked to do here by John. Look on the one we've pierced. And see, of course, love. Paul, in what I think is his earliest letter, written to the Galatians, it's chapter 2, verse 19, says, I've been crucified with the Messiah. I've been crucified, not literally, he wasn't crucified on a cross, but he was crucified by his Jewish compatriots who saw him as a turncoat. He was crucified by a lot of the Christians too, who thought he was underselling the gospel by not demanding that all the people who become Christians become Jews first, be circumcised and follow the Torah, etc. So he can say, I've been crucified with the Messiah. But then he goes straight on to say, it's no longer I who live. The Messiah lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God loving me and giving himself for me. When Paul looks at the suffering of Jesus, he sees love. He sees Jesus' faith in God. And he sees Jesus, the Son of God, loving him and giving himself for Paul. And of course, therefore, for the people that Paul is sharing the gospel with. In the year 1900, Jules Chevalier, the founder of the Missionaries of the Sacred Heart and the Daughters of Our Lady of the Sacred Heart, wrote these beautiful words. From the heart of Jesus, pierced on Calvary, I see a new world coming forth, a great and life-giving world inspired by love and mercy, a world which the Church must perpetuate on the whole earth. As we look at Jesus' pierced heart on the cross, he shows us that when people behave badly towards us, we don't have to respond in the same way. Love one another, Jesus said, just as I love you. Love them with my love, which I give you, the love I've received and receive always from my Father. Jesus shows us how to respond in love, even in the worst situations. That's why he could say, love your enemies. Don't let your enemies change you so that you stop loving. Stay who you are. Love with my love. It's this loving which makes the message so convincing. It's this which draws us to follow Jesus. In a sense, I think we can say that we needed to see Jesus loving on the cross. Not because God demanded a crucifixion, but because nothing less could convince us that in our suffering, we, like Jesus, are surrounded by the unconditional and persistent love of God. Suffering, even when unjustly afflicted, doesn't have to stop our loving. If, in our human way, we're to imagine God responding to the crucifixion, I think we should imagine God weeping as Jesus wept over the city. This is God's reaction to all the terrible injustices that we humans inflict on each other by our sinful rejection of God's loving inspiration. God cannot pretend that things are other than they really are. Sin, however, cannot change the truth that God is love. This love, demonstrated by the way Jesus died, is the source of all our hope. If we believe it, we may dare the journey out of sin. And if enough people believe it, there's still hope of realizing Jesus' dream of God's will being done on earth as it is in heaven.